The news department of the National Broadcasting Company presents Eisenhower Abroad, the sixth in a series of special reports on the president's 11-nation tour. Your narrator is Leon Pearson of NBC News.
The president's personal physician probably breathed easier when a helicopter settled down on the deck of the U.S. heavy cruiser Des Moines yesterday among the islands of Greece, and Mr. Eisenhower stepped into a new world. This is the sort of relaxation that President Roosevelt used to know and love, where a man can do as he pleases. Since that hour, President Eisenhower has been dressed in a sports shirt and slacks, has been sleeping copiously, working only very little, and the sea and sun have been hospitable. Certainly the critical two-thirds of the mission have been put behind him, though some very difficult moments lie ahead in Paris. Apparently, people along the president's route are amazed not only by the tremendous and noisy jet plane that cuts continents in half, but also by that small chopper, which defies all the laws of gravity. Of course, it was the jet plane that carried the president from Tehran, ancient Persia, to Athens in a mere 4 hours, causing an erudite Greek lady to recall how long it took the Persian Xerxes to make the same journey 500 years before Christ. She said, "If Miltiades had received the news that Xerxes was leaving Persia for Greece, he would have prepared to meet him 4 months later." The Eisenhower visit to Greece was much more successful than the Xerxes visit, but it can be best appreciated against the background of the Greek crisis of 10 or 12 years ago. Then Greece was torn by a frightful civil war and a communist effort to take it over for the communist bloc. To recapture that period, we have asked for a report from a distinguished American who has traveled widely and written wisely about that part of the world, Justice William O. Douglas of the U.S. Supreme Court.
I first saw Greece at a dreadful time in Greek history, and that was when the communist guerrillas had almost taken it over. They were everywhere, little pockets everywhere. President Truman announced a policy of military assistance to Greece, and his courage in doing that and the promptness of the American reaction to that undoubtedly saved Greece. I was up in Macedonia on the final liquidation of the communist guerrillas. The communist bloc cut Greece off from many of her markets for olive oil and things of that kind. So Greece had to reestablish her markets, build new trade alliances with the West. Greece today is a very prosperous, happy, viable, democratic society that is doing a fine job on all fronts. The Queen of Greece has been an outstanding person through all the times of trouble and all the times of prosperity. She has walked with grace and dignity among the poor. At the time of the communist trouble, was organizing displaced girls into homes and working out programs for them to help in the restoration of the country. She has a very keen sense of public responsibility, and I think is one of the really fine people of the world.
Our thanks to Justice Douglas. The helicopters were working again today, shuttling between the cruiser Des Moines and the aircraft carrier Essex, bringing Mrs. John Eisenhower to the Essex for luncheon with Admiral Anderson, commander of the U.S. 6th Fleet. The band of the Essex played Little Girl as Barbara landed on the flight deck. And the helicopters are shunting Press Secretary Hagerty over to the Essex to brief the newsmen on the activities of the president. Our next report is from NBC's Bill Henry aboard the Essex. Difficult transmission here. The Essex has a radio transmitter, not very powerful, but it has carried Bill Henry's voice to Tangiers, North Africa, where it was boosted by a stronger transmitter to New York. The signal is not the best, but this is a report from aboard the Essex, cruising westward with the president in the Mediterranean.
This is Bill Henry, NBC News, with the president in the Mediterranean. Perhaps the most vital question that was asked of President Eisenhower at his last news conference in Washington before leaving on this 11-nation, 23,000-mile trip concerned the fact that he alone can give the word to use the atom bomb. And he was asked how he would take care of such a situation should the need occur while he was on this trip. The president's reply was that he cannot delegate this authority, which is his alone by law, but that during this trip he would be in constant touch, much as if he were in the White House. And since this was just a matter of sending a word or two, his travels would make no difference. The actual fact is that this week, aboard the cruiser Des Moines, the president, to all practical purposes, is no farther away from his job than if, instead of being actually in his White House executive office, he was somewhere else in the White House where he could be reached by telephone or messenger. Aboard the Des Moines, there is a special radio telephone set up called the Presidential Circuit, which is always open to the White House in Washington. The president sends and has received numerous messages every day and has done so from the beginning of this trip. He has the same service aboard his White House airplane, and he carries communications gear which can be set up in the presidential palaces wherever he may be staying. On this trip, the Navy also stationed a communication ship just offshore in the Arabian Sea off Karachi, Pakistan, and it was in a position to act as a relay station for White House messages. Communications are, as a matter of fact, excellent throughout this whole small fleet which accompanies the president across the Mediterranean. There's a special airmail service, for instance, for use in case there are official documents for the president to see or sign. Jet planes fly regularly from Washington to the Mediterranean shore stations. There, the documents are transferred to Navy carrier planes, which deliver them to the carrier Essex, from which this broadcast is originating. And the documents are then carried by helicopter from the Essex to the Des Moines, the presidential cruiser, which is only a few thousand yards away. Should it be necessary to transmit a document with even more speed, both the Des Moines and the Essex are equipped with the most modern photo facsimile equipment, which they use regularly for the transmission of weather maps. According to Secretary Jim Haggerty, there has been no interruption at any time, and the president, while physically a third of the world away, is in fact no farther away from his White House office than just picking up a telephone. This is Bill Henry of NBC News with the president in the Mediterranean.
The flyers on the Essex had a good audience today, and they didn't waste the opportunity. They staged for the commander-in-chief, Mr. Eisenhower, an air show by fighter planes, that is, rocket-firing fighters, which are catapulted off the deck of a carrier by steam catapults, and which land again so fast that they can be stopped only by catching the hooks of the tail fins into steel cables stretched across the deck. I say they lost no chance to make this display. I became aware from spending 2 days aboard another carrier of the same Mediterranean fleet, the Intrepid, recently, how sensitive these men are about the future of the carrier, sometimes called a floating target, and they want to demonstrate that here, at least, is an airfield which, when the missiles begin to fly, does not stand in one place. Later in the day, President Eisenhower received a 21-gun salute from the commander of the British Mediterranean Fleet, Sir Alexander Bingley, who sailed out from Malta. His band played the Star Spangled Banner, and the Des Moines band played God Save the Queen. Perhaps the salute might be taken symbolically as a recognition by an arm of England of the fact that the arm of England is not so strong in that inland sea as it was, and that a good deal of its muscle has been transferred to the arm of Uncle Sam. The British have lost power and authority in Greece, Turkey, Egypt, Iran, Pakistan, India, as the United States has become what might be called an imperial power without imperial designs. Well, the absence of the president from Washington puts the vice president in a somewhat different light. And Mr. Nixon himself is quite aware of an increased number of newsmen dogging his footsteps these days.
This is Herb Kaplow, NBC News, Washington. Vice President Nixon is one of the first to explain that the presidency goes with the president wherever that may be.
But one thing we have to realize is that the presidency always follows the president wherever he is.
That's right.
Now, while he's gone, however, the business of government here goes right along. Like, for example, I will preside over a cabinet meeting this week and a Security Council meeting, and where various other domestic matters come up, I will have the opportunity to advise with cabinet officers or other government officials where otherwise the president might. But I should make clear that the power of decision goes with the president wherever he is, and right there he makes the big decisions if they have to be made.
Modern communications make it possible for the chief executive to be relayed information from Washington and respond to it as only a president can in quick time. Nevertheless, short of the major decisions reserved to the president, certain added executive duties fall to the vice president when his superior is away. In the case of the Eisenhower-Nixon relationship, This may be more so than in past administrations because of the added responsibilities, the higher place in the councils of the mighty given to the vice president. Before President Eisenhower departed for this latest trip abroad, he called upon Vice President Nixon, who had visited all 11 nations presently involved, to give him his impressions of these nations and offer suggestions that might prove helpful to Mr. Eisenhower. There were two or three of these personal discussions. Also at these times, the President, in effect, left a list of instructions to Mr. Nixon as to what should be done at home while Mr. Eisenhower was away. Liaison between the White House and the Vice President's office in Suite 361 of the old Senate office building is maintained in large part through daily phone calls between the Vice President and the President Eisenhower's staff chief at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Major General Wilton Persons. Likewise, the Vice President these days is being visited more than normally by executive agency heads who, when the President is in town, would go to the White House. Also, Mr. Nixon is involved in certain ceremonial activities which might otherwise occur in the President's office. For instance, yesterday morning, the Vice President attended a breakfast at the Capitol for the Cartoonist Committee of the President's Committee on Employment of the Physically Handicapped. A little later, he presented the Collier Aviation Trophy. These activities are not necessarily added on top of such events already on the Vice President's agenda. They take the place of them. Perhaps the most apparent filling in the Vice President does is to preside over meetings of the Hush Hush National Security Council and the Cabinet. Last week, these groups met Thursday and Friday in the White House. Before each, the Vice President conferred for half an hour or so with the administrative secretaries of both groups, Robert Gray for the Cabinet, Gordon Gray for the NSC. Then, for another 2.5 hours or so in each instance, Mr. Nixon studied the material involved in the upcoming meetings. Actual interchange of information between the President and the Vice President has involved coded cables or else information relayed through general persons. The Vice President received a 2-page, single-spaced, capital-lettered message from the President giving the Chief Executive's impressions of his trip up through the visit to India. Mr. Nixon, in turn, has relayed to the President a report on conditions in Washington and the public reaction to the President's trip. Herb Kaplow, NBC News, Washington.
The cruiser Des Moines is making a leisurely 10 knots, and tomorrow morning that helicopter will warm up again to carry the President directly from the decks to a landing strip near the presidential palace of Habib Bourguiba, President of the Young Republic of Tunisia. This will be a breakfast meeting between the two presidents, 2-hour breakfast, and then a return by helicopter to the Des Moines. Bourguiba is a unique political figure among the emerging new nations of Africa. Ed Newman of NBC knows the country and the man.
Habib Bourguiba is one of the leading actors on the world scene today, not in terms of power or influence. The president of the Tunisian Republic, a poor country with a population of 3.25 million, does not marshal very impressive forces. But histrionically speaking, Bourguiba is one of the best. He's a small man, but upright, straight as a ramrod. His face is powerful and symmetrical. His lower jaw juts out. His eyes are intense, his smile flashing and disarming. Bourguiba is also a great orator, though in the tradition of Nasser of Egypt and Tito of Yugoslavia and Castro of Cuba, he will sometimes speak for hours at a time. His high, thin voice rises and falls as he runs through a series of emotions: patriotism, exhortation, ridicule, pride, sweet reason, indignation, reassurance, what you will. His hands move incessantly. His face portrays whatever feeling his words evoke. He never uses a note, and he seems never to be at a loss. Many of his countrymen are poorly educated or not educated at all. For them, Bourguiba speaks a homely Arabic, full of pointed little stories and parables. Every Thursday, he speaks on the Tunisian radio, and the coffee shops are full of men listening earnestly, then discussing what he said. Bourguiba personifies the government of his country to an unusual degree. His picture is on Tunisia's new currency and on its postage stamps. His photograph hangs in almost every shop. His picture is on posters everywhere, usually driving home some point or other, but also sometimes just giving a cheery smile and wave. If this seems somewhat immodest, the justification is that it enables the untutored people of the country to understand that one of themselves is in charge. It might be added that Bourguiba is one of those men who came straight from arrest by the colonial power to the leadership of their countries, and Nkrumah of Ghana is another. It's the sort of experience that leaves its mark, and incidentally, it also leaves the man who went through it somewhat intolerant of political opponents. By disposition and belief, Bourguiba is linked with the West. On the personal side, he married a French woman. He himself is invariably dressed in a well-cut Western-style suit. His shirt and light-colored tie are always in the best of taste. Dark glasses go on if he's out of doors, and one Eastern touch if it's cold, he wears a red fez. Politically, Bourguiba prizes his country's connection with the United States, and he places a high value on American aid. But he finds it useful now and then to announce that he doesn't get enough help from the United States, or that there's an excessive degree of supervision, and that he may soon be looking for aid somewhere else, meaning Russia. Bourguiba may, in fact, someday be forced into taking help from the Russians by groups within Tunisia who think his attachment to the West does not pay dividends, but he's unlikely ever to do it if he can help it. One quality Bourguiba has that is pretty rare. He's a master at dealing with the press. I myself have interviewed him 3 times. He always remembers me, or at any rate finds out who I am before he sees me. He answers all questions directly and without notes, and he understands that television interviews entail some delay and discomfort, and he submits. Also, he has a lively sense of what makes news and what doesn't, and when it makes news and when it doesn't. Bourguiba's greatest problem is the war in Algeria. Algeria is his next-door neighbor. He openly aids the rebels there as they fight France. That, of course, affects his relations with France, but in addition, the Algerian rebels quartered on Tunisian soil probably could bring him down by a military coup whenever they pleased. Moreover, the war holds up development of his own country, and so he'd like to see more American pressure on France to get the Algerian war ended. Bourguiba, then, is the head of a poor country with a fine assortment of difficulties. He has neither enough natural resources at his disposal nor enough trained people. He's short on capital also, but he has wisdom, charm, fire, and shrewdness, and he has much pride. That is why President Eisenhower abandoned his plan to see Bourguiba aboard the cruiser Des Moines and instead will go ashore. Bourguiba wanted to be a host like the others, not a guest. Finally, Bourguiba is liberally endowed with ambition. He'd like someday to be a counterpoise in the Arab world to Nasser of Egypt. He's not very likely to make that, but he is, all the same, a very considerable man. This is Edwin Newman, NBC News, Paris.
Considerable attention has focused on Bourguiba because of his balance, his moderation. Chet Huntley of NBC has visited and talked with him and gives us other lights and shades in the portrait.
Habib Bourguiba is one of the best friends France ever had, although millions of Frenchmen and many French political leaders still don't know it. Notwithstanding the fact that Bourguiba has spent about half his adult life in French prisons because of his political activity in behalf of Tunisian independence, yet he insists that his country must become a part of French culture. Bourguiba grows eloquent when he talks of the beauty and precision of the French language, the delicacy of French thought, the wealthy heritage of French literature, drama, music, and law. On one occasion, Bourguiba avoided execution before a French firing squad by a matter of minutes. His wife and son had been notified to appear at the prison to claim his body. Just minutes before the appointed hour, a French agent acknowledged that he had planted a damaging document so that it might indict Bourguiba. And once during the war, Bourguiba was being held in prison in southeastern France by the Vichy French regime. When the Allies invaded North Africa, the Vichyites panicked and began to execute their prisoners. Bourguiba again was awaiting his turn to step to the wall when the Germans wheeled into the prison yard and took command. Bourguiba finished the war as a prisoner of the Germans. The Tunisian president has little patience for the old Arab and Muslim traditions which tend to retard the progress of his country. For example, he wages an unremitting struggle in behalf of the emancipation of Tunisian women. He scoffs at the notion that marriages must be prearranged. He encourages young Tunisian men to court the girls. I saw the crowd which gathers in Tunis each morning to greet the president as he enters the National Palace and go to his office. And another crowd, by the way, assembles as he leaves the office in late afternoon to visit the mosque before driving to his home, which is situated about a dozen miles outside the city on the edge of the old ruins of Carthage. Bourguiba will usually plunge into the crowd, and there ensues a moment of lively squealing and laughter as he teases the women by lifting their veils, an act which would get most men torn apart on the spot, and he tells them they should get rid of that piece of no-good cloth over their heads. André Philippe is one of the most highly regarded political writers and commentators in France, and one time I remember in Paris I asked Philippe what he thought of Bourguiba. He said that if France should ever form the projected confederacy with Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco, that he would do all in his power to see that Bourguiba became the first president of the confederation. Last Christmas, I received a greeting card from Habib Bourguiba Jr., who is his father's most trusted diplomat and emissary. And on the bottom of the card, Habib Jr. had written, "My father wants to know if you're ready to take the post of foreign minister in his cabinet." It reflected the good nature and the sense of humor of the Tunisian president.
Tomorrow afternoon and evening, the president will be cruising again, headed for the French Mediterranean port of Toulon, between Nice and Marseille, from where he takes a train, yes, I said a train for a change, to Paris. In the final moments of this broadcast, a reflection now on the significance of the president's journey. Both Adlai Stevenson and Dean Acheson have said in the past few days they doubted the president's trip would have any lasting benefits. And a Coles publication called The Insider's Newsletter declares rather pompously, quote, "Don't expect much from Ike's trip. The world tour is mostly a personal farewell to office and something of a diversion for the president who is fatigued by official Washington duties." Well, this statement seems to me ridiculous, for it leaves out of account the fact that diplomacy need not be performed in the starched and secret manner of the old tradition. True, the president has not been conducting negotiations in India or Iran or Greece, but he has created an atmosphere within which negotiations can be better conducted. And what is perhaps equally important, he has created impressions and understandings in his own mind which will lead to action in his high office. This is Leon Pearson, NBC News, New York.
This has been Eisenhower Abroad, the sixth in a series of special reports on the president's 11-nation tour, produced for NBC News by Patrick Tracy. Your narrator has been Leon Pearson. The seventh report in this series will be heard Saturday, December 19th, over most of these NBC stations. This is Fred Collins speaking.